Embracing AI technology can empower your company to grow, innovate, and thrive in today's rapidly evolving business. By harnessing the potential of AI, you can unlock new opportunities, improve operational efficiency, and ultimately provide better products and services to your customers. Before determining what AI means for your company, you'll need to understand the fundamentals of AI. In this episode of the Privately Speaking podcast series, host and KPMG private enterprise partner Erica Whitmore sits down with Per Eden, Principal Advisory KPMG, to discuss further.
All right. So, Per, I am so excited to have you here with us today. Thank you for joining our Privately Speaking podcast. It's literally one of my favorite things to do. So I'm glad that you agreed to join today. And with that, I'd really like you to introduce yourself just to make sure we get proper credit to all your background. I would love if you could introduce yourself.
Well, thank you so much. So excited to be here and happy to do so. First of all, the name Per Eden, it means Peter in Swedish. I do live in Silicon Valley these many years, but I often have to do that and I spell it in a funny way. Yeah, so long and interesting history, I guess, with AI that started, I'll date myself, but in 1992, I did my first internship at a company called AI Systems in Europe. Okay. So I've been through a couple of summers and winters when it comes to AI, but obviously almost to the day today, 1 year ago, the world changed, right? With the launch of ChatGPT-4 and, you know, some would say, you know, 3 or 3.5 before that, but essentially that's it. So wear many hats. I do serve on the board of KPMG in the US. I chair the committee that oversees a lot of our investments in technology and AI. So I can put the board lens
on
that.
Thank you for your service. That's so important.
Thank you. Thank you. But in my day job also since November, I've been asked to more or less drop everything else and focus just on AI and how we can engage with companies in the market, clients and future clients, on helping them through this journey as we also navigate this journey together. And that's been a very interesting ride so far. We've been extremely busy and there's been a lot of interesting incoming requests from all types of companies and boards.
I bet.
And I've had the pleasure of speaking to many of them. I do have a technical background. I'm an electrical engineer and started my career in the European Space Agency. Yes, they have one. It's like NASA, but smaller, satellites and stuff. And then wandered into McKinsey and spent 17 years there as a consultant, and then jumped ship and went to, with one of my clients to lead a part of Cisco's business, head of strategy and M&A for their services business, both technical and professional services. And then KPMG for 7 years, helping build up our strategy practice in Silicon Valley, leading a bunch of accounts and so forth. So long history and many different perspectives. And AI has been a key component in all of that. And some of those key decisions, even coming to KPMG, it did play a role. And I could dig out my old business plan for our strategy practice recently, and we already had AI as phase three there on the chart back in the day. This was 2016. So, but then obviously that was a different type of AI at the time. Sure. It was machine learning, RPA, and so forth. But very happy to be here and see if I can take sort of both the sort of board view, but also the advisory perspective, and with some nuances on what are we seeing on the private equity, VC funded part of the business, and how are small and big companies kind of positioning themselves for this trend?
Yes. No, perfect. And at risk of having our risk folks remove this from the podcast, but I would like to call you our resident expert because I think that's what you are. So very
subject matter professional with a lot of experience.
We'll stick with that. Subject matter expert. I do think we can use that term. But I do think, you know, in terms of our audience, right, Per, like we kind of talked about a little bit, I think we've likely got varying degrees. You know, obviously, I think most people know the nuts and bolts of AI at this point, but I also think it's always healthy, right, to ground people in here's kind of the basics, right? So maybe just to kick us off, why don't you share just like here's some of the basic fundamentals that you kind of need to understand, you know, before you even start determining, you know, what does this mean for your company?
Yeah, no, and it's actually really good, and you know, not a simplistic question at all. I would say up until a year ago, AI meant using the latest and greatest technology to replace what people do. So machine learning, you know, training models to make recommendation based on seeing patterns in data. We use it a lot for churn prediction, for instance, for customers. You know, figuring out what patterns lead to different type of activities. So it's predictive analytics, but essentially provided a functionality where a human had previously done a piece of work. And all those models had to be built from scratch. You know, you have to take the data, you have to build the model, train the model, et cetera. And you know, a couple of the big changes now, of course, is with generative AI. It means that the technology can generate output. And this, you know, in this case, primarily text, but also we're seeing a lot of video and other things coming down the pipe. And they can do so thanks to huge investments by large technology companies that have trained these models basically on everything that's available digitally, you know, in the outside world. And think of them as knowledge factories that any company can now tap into for a subscription fee. You no longer need to build those large language models that are at the foundation of this. And pros and cons, but that's sort of a, you can hack into a massive investment by large companies. And those tools have proven to be much more effective and interesting than anyone had thought up until when you got to that GPT 3 to 4 transition. I like to say that, you know, any technology or anyone that can pass the bar exam and the sommelier exam and all those things, you know, it's got my attention. And the models were able to do that by basic, you know, statistical predictions of what words fit together. And the output can be almost magical and scary, but it's not sentient. It's not a thinking model. It's a statistical prediction model. But the good news is that for many of the tasks that we do today as knowledge workers, and by knowledge workers, I include almost anyone that spends most of their time in front of a PC or a phone or a tablet and look at numbers and text, produce recommendations, produce you know, reports, insights, decision, et cetera, which is a large portion of the working population. For us, a lot of the tasks we do are actually time-consuming and basic, like reading, writing, synthesizing, merging, and all of that is these tools are really, really good at. They're not good at many other things, but these they are really good at. And we're still exploring how good they are standalone and how good they can be if you allow the tools to work on some of your own data, your own sales data, or your own HR data, et cetera, which needs a little bit of data plumbing, if you will. But I would say that. So it's like you're using pre-built models, and there are many more models out there now, and we're getting to see both small large language models as well, you know, ironically, and that can start to fit on a PC or even your phone in the near future, standalone. And you are seeing other new technologies. You might have heard of the large action models coming out right now, which also help take action, not only produce a text output, but can help, you know, click on apps and, you know, book flights, et cetera, for you if you allow it. So we see some trend, but primarily right now, the buzz is around the generative AI models, the GPT models. And the embedded software models like Microsoft Copilot or Salesforce, Einstein GPT, these things that tool software providers build into the existing tools, such that when you use a spreadsheet or a PowerPoint or other presentation material, you can directly access a large chunk of that intelligence in the tool itself. So we see those things roll out in parallel right now, which is very interesting. And the final key difference is at, you know, by large, not exclusively, this is all about tools helping to make knowledge workers in their current role, doing their current job, you know, 10, 20, 30, 40% more productive, more creative, in many cases more happy, and to be a tool for people, not to replace people, but to replace tasks that people perform today. And that's unique about the technology, and that creates a lot opportunities, but also challenges in rolling it out, which means right. that you have to work with people. Right. You have to convince people to use the tools and to use it productively, and you know, the time freed up to reinvest that in right. areas that drive productivity. And I would say those are the big the big differences between traditional legacy AI, machine learning, robotic process automation, natural language processing, and the new generative kinds.
Well, so I'm gonna jump around a little bit compared to what we planned, Per, but I think just following on with that, right? And you talked about increasing workers' productivity and, you know, helping them do their jobs better, I think is the way that you put it. So in terms of, you know, as we sit today, you know, what opportunities do you think, and again, just listening or just thinking about our audience, right, and companies in all different stages of growth, some growing very, very fast and some growing in the tech space and maybe even consumer products, things like that. Which industries do you think there's the most opportunity for AI to truly move the needle in terms of those types of companies, businesses, and, yeah. and how fast they grow and how they grow?
Yes. No, and I'll answer it in a roundabout way, saying that in every industry, in every function, there is benefit to be had. How much benefit essentially depends on two things. How many knowledge workers do you have? And what share of their work is easily augmented by existing sure. or near-term tools? And you know, if you look back 6 to 9 months ago, all the calls we were getting, we probably had more than 1,000 interactions in 12 months with different types of companies. In the beginning, it was all about use cases. What's the use case? Tell me a use case, specific thing that I could do, whether I'm in finance or I'm in the sector, et cetera. And there's a lot of questions and good questions around that still. What we're also finding is that there's a shift from looking at those use cases to users. Yep. And the view that if you look at any company, large or small, and you take that, call it 80% of the employees that might qualify as knowledge workers, if you actually knew what they were doing with their time, you could start taking out layer after layer of the most boring, repetitive work and right. free up that time. And there's a lot of studies out there, you know, very few at scale still, but there are a few ones that have been larger scale. One that everyone knows of is the call center agents.
Sure.
There's been a big use case, 5,000 agents in a B2B environment, and they proved that they could, with a very simple Gen AI enabled tool, they could take out 14% of the hours of the call center agents. Which
That's
may not
good.
Sound a lot, but in call center, 14% is massive.
Yeah, absolutely.
But the other finding was that the benefit was not uniform. So the highest performing call center agents didn't get a lot of benefit. Mm-hmm. It was the newer employees, new hires, and maybe lower half performing that got a real productivity boost. So in this particular case, they proved that, you know, a new hire got to average productivity 4 months faster if they were aided by the tool okay. in this case. And we're seeing that pattern in almost every area of adoption. Another famous case right now is actually business and strategy consultants. Harvard Business Review did a study with 750 consultants from one of our competitors, so I won't name their name.
Sure.
And they basically divided you know, those consultants into three groups: one that did the work they used to, the way they used to; one that got a GPT-like tool with no data, no training; and one that got the tool and training but no data.
Okay.
And then they had to solve the same business tasks, if you will. And the groups that got any type of support by GPT could deliver equal quality of work with 20 to 40% less hours.
Not Did you for say all. How hours. Many less hours, or just less hours?
20 to 40% less hours.
Wow.
Right.
That's a lot.
And this is a population of 750 people divided in three groups. So it's, you know, right. not at scale, but and that's a good indication, I think, where in you know, what you should expect as a company in any function is finance, sales, supply chain, you know, HR, etc. Now, all tasks were not delivered at the same quality. There were issues around the more complex tasks. So you got to kind of know what the tool is good at.
Yes.
Get the full benefit.
That's part of really, like you said, getting the most benefit out of the tool is literally understanding how to phrase the prompts. And I know that that's getting better every day, but that matters a lot, right?
Matters a lot, and how to ask the right questions and to instruct the tool not to guess, not to hallucinate if it's uncertain, because otherwise, it does produce an answer. So prompt engineering or prompt crafting is now, at least for the time being, a really sought after skill that you know, almost any person, you know, can learn, right? So instead of learning to code, you are asking questions to the data. Right. And, you know, there's some skill in how to ask the questions. And that's why I'm saying it's all industries and so forth. But, I mean, there are some variations where you have higher density of knowledge workers and higher density of easily augmentable work. The first to look for is anything to do with software production and creation and coding.
Yes.
You know, everyone is already seeing 40, 50, 60% productivity improvement using these type of tools to create a 60, 70% ready piece of code, or translating a piece of code from one language to another, which was a big surprise that, you know, the models treat code as they treat language, and they can already speak most of the languages on the planet. So why not another one?
Right.
There's a lot of old code out there that needs to be translated. And a lot of the work goes into commenting on the code as well, which these models are really good at. So that's an obvious area. Any part of the business or any industry that has a lot of software production immediately gets this benefit. Customer interactions is the other area, both call centers, sales agents, etc. Not to replace the human, it's not that, but to augment the human in being more productive and better at answering. And this was an unexpected takeaway from the call center example I gave earlier, that the agents became happier and the churn went down when they were augmented by the tool. Because
the churn of the agents themselves, pair, meaning the companies had less turnover in their own employee base.
Yes, because a big challenge for call centers is that it's a very taxing job and repetitive, and a lot of people go in and out, and then you have to retrain. So that was an unexpected benefit, that they felt they could do a better job. Their customers were happier, and churn, at least in this example, went down. And I think that's a sign of things that we should expect in many of these areas.
Can I ask another question? Because it's burning for me. And I've read a little bit about this, so I might be leading a little bit here. But for the benefit of our audience, what about, as consumers, right? Restaurants and fast food, and think about those, going to a sporting goods store, any type of, again, those would, I would consider those non-knowledge workers, right? What kind of trends are you seeing there?
Yeah, I mean, again, a lot of the tools that you can apply to be more productive in those types of engagements. So, for instance, if you are a sales rep and you can understand more about your customer, whether it's a company or a consumer, going into the discussion by using a tool like this. So market research and scripting are among the most common things to use these tools for. And the recommendation engines, right? So if customer says X, Y, or Z, should I recommend product ABC or to get a matching like that? So things that are based on a lot of transactions and a lot of data points on how customers choose, they can be augmented by that as well.
Sure.
Area types of works that are harder to augment, I mean, if you're physically, in a machine shop, or you're painting fences, or you're in creative arts, and the physical activities of exercising those jobs are less augmentable, if you will. But still, a lot of the creative parts there, we're currently working with a sneaker company that was less interested in the cost productivity, but they wanted to be able to develop better sneakers faster for different customer.
So that's important, right? To keep refreshing the trends, right? And offering new products to your customers. Yeah.
Yeah. And by applying generative AI tools to the creative process they applied, they could shorten the time from ideation and the quality of ideation to product. And another interesting application there is synthetic consumer panels. So, you know, at some point in the process, you often put together, you know, real customers to react to a product or a service and record. And, you know, they are helpful, but sometimes also people in those situations don't react the way they do in real life because they are in a controlled environment and they influence each other, et cetera.
Sure.
We're seeing examples of synthetic panels where you basically, you instruct the model to act in accordance with a certain set of customer characteristics. Mm-hmm. And then try a new product or service. How would you react to this offer? And you test it on a large number of virtual customers before you go to the expense of testing it on real customers.
Okay.
And this is an emerging, you know,
interesting. I hadn't heard of this. This sounds really interesting.
Yeah. And now you got to instruct the, you know, the model to behave like you think a real customer would, right? And if you instruct it incorrectly, then you get the wrong answer, of course. But so those are some examples of what we're seeing. And the topic of hallucination comes up a lot, right? So how can you trust models? And you know, it's absolutely true. The word hallucination is a little bit misleading because it kind of implies it's sort of
crazy.
Something that's not there or gone crazy or trying to trick you, right?
Right.
It's basically that statistically, with a certain percentage, you put together words that then come out to be, you know, inaccurate, because there are, you know, statistical chances that you would say something like this about that. And the model also knows that. So if you prompt it correctly, you can say what I said earlier, that if you're uncertain, don't make up. Say you're not certain.
Sure.
You can guide it to reduce that risk. But at the end of the day, it's the human in the loop that is the key safeguard for that.
Right.
If you think about generative AI as a model to automate and take humans out of the loop, then you have a lot of these challenges to overcome. If you think about it as a junior assistant that helps you draft a 60-70% ready document or response for which you are still responsible for, then you get closer to the truth, right? And, you know, whenever you have a new hire on your team that seems really smart but not experienced, you will spend enough time with that person to make sure you get the full benefit, but also that you filter some of the output. And that's the right way to think about these models as well. They're not human, but they act as junior assistants. Think of them as a digital assistant that helps you do part of your job, not to replace. And once you get into that mindset, a lot of these concerns are more manageable, as long as you have a way to react to. I mean, whoever, you know, puts in their own history, etc. And I did it early on, right? And it was, you know, 99% of what it produced about who is Per Eden and what has he done was 100% accurate, except for one thing, which is a company I've never worked for, and you know, somehow got there, and it's very hard to say why, right?
Yeah, sure.
Like somebody
it's constantly ingesting information, right, and data, and so it's constantly learning. So who knows?
And it could have been that there's there's patterns of people moving from different companies to other companies, and who knows, right?
But sure.
Those are some of the sort of what will be impacted most. So I would say knowledge worker intensive, a lot of the hours on easier stuff than the most complex stuff. And then in parts of those companies where you do a lot of repetitive knowledge work, right? Important and critical and difficult, but sort of following the same pattern, filling in a form, reporting, And there are a lot of jobs out there
absolutely
take a lot of time on that. So I said that's where to look for the biggest upside.
Well, and I think just reiterating what you just said, right, is looking at this as a junior employee or somebody who was just hired, and your point on one that's very smart, because that's true, right? I think is a really great way to look at it. Well, I want to make sure we get to this question because I think it's really important. So I'll come back to the other questions that we had talked about if we have time. But in terms of, you know, if you're a leader of, you know, a high growth company, whether it's, again, large or small, and really in any industry, you know, what are some of the things that these leaders should be doing right now? Yeah. And I would say both, you know, what can they do internally? And frankly, right, and this isn't, our topic isn't about cybersecurity, but you can't ignore it, right? What are some things that they also might need to consider asking others, you know, for help?
Absolutely. I mean, I'll rattle out a few things that sort of like what we see in the middle right now. If you're not doing many of these, you're probably a little bit behind. And if you're doing all of them, you're probably a little bit, you know, ahead right now, but it's moving very quickly. And I would say the first thing is you have to provide your employees with a safe corporate version of these models to work with in the day-to-day life.
Right.
For the simple reason that if you're not, they are going to use their private, commercial, open models. And there's nothing wrong with them per se, but you do want to make sure that what you put into the model and what you prompt the model with is controlled by you. And there are easy ways to do it. You know, in our case, we have built our own version of the engine where we use the power of the external engine and we put in a filter that anything that any of our employees prompted cannot escape from our firewalls, essentially. And we now have somewhere between 2.5 and 3 million prompts since May on this system.
This is amazing.
We can see, you know, the trend there. So I think that's step number one. If you don't, there's going to be a risk element, and it's probably the biggest risk, not only because you would expose yourself, but also you're not then experimenting with the technology. Then I would say start experimenting, because there's so much learning in trying different things, and it's very risky to sit on the sidelines and not try any of those.
So
get a few experiments going and try to find areas in the company where you can see some immediate benefit. We call them proof of concepts. It's basically pilots. You know, it's an area. What many did in the beginning is sort of pick a use case. Somebody in the leadership team or somebody said, hey, okay, we got this new, you know, amazing technology. Let's try to do something that no human has ever done. And that's very accurate, it takes a lot of data, etc., and go pilot that. And many of them came back disappointed because that's not what the generative AI models are really good at. That they're really good at doing the base load of human knowledge workers, you know, faster and easier. So there was a lot of learnings what to do and not to do, and simple things like many companies forgot to put in a baseline. So once they were done, they could measure how much better, you know, the augmented process was, and therefore it was hard to build a business case to scale. So we put together our own 8-step process for how to run these proof of concepts in a way that makes them safe, productive, and replicable.
Okay.
That's a good learning. But start experimenting with them. We call that top-down innovation. But equally important is just make sure that every employee in the area that you're trying to address has access to it and can start taking away hours from the day-to-day work. But don't stop there. You know, productively grow and look at large chunk of people and saying, okay, that if there's 1 hour that we can shave away from 1,000 people or 100 or 10,
right,
it's more important than one person, you know, taking 50% of their hours out, right? And many times you don't really know what a number of employees spend their time on.
Right.
So there are ways to figuring that out. Let them figure it out, measure it, etc. And then you basically said, okay, let's take the bottom third of these and say, can we solve this with basic tools without any data? Yes or no. Take another tranche that says we can solve this, but only if we provide a little bit more of data. And let's do those. And then the third level is, there are some things that could really be disruptive, right? You could change the way you work together, not only how effective you are in the current role, could even change the business model you're in. Those are typically less well suited for incremental, approaches and driven by the operational line. And we recommend taking those out and treating them as startups, if you will, within the company. And you know, because 9 out of 10 may fail, but one can be really disruptive. So we call them moonshots, and run those as startups in an accelerated type environment, internally or externally. So that's the sort of bottom up innovation, I would say. Now, there are a few other things you should be doing. You should start looking over your governance model and make sure that from a board and a management perspective, you're making yourself aware of the procedures and principles that can help you minimize any unwanted risk. And that includes cyber risk. So a simple way to think about it is just, cyber criminals are knowledge workers too.
Right.
And minimum, they will be 30 to 60% more productive. So to stay the same, you kind of need to raise your moat, need to raise your defenses by that amount to just be at equal levels of risk. And there's some other specific, we're very proud of a company called Cranium that we actually spun out of our own accelerator that's now doing really well in the market and addressing some of these comments. So look up Cranium if you want to be at the at that forefront of that wave. So that you need to do. And we do recommend that although the first wave may not need a ton of data, the second wave will. And the sooner you get your data in a cloud-based format that whichever platform you choose, and you can start feeding the models to poke at that data in a controlled way, the better. And that could take some time. If you have all your data in the basement, it could take 18, 36
months.
That's
really important, right? Because to your point, you can't even really go there, right, unless you have everything in the cloud. Is that a fair
statement? Yeah. I mean, you can do some things, but it gets much easier. And most companies were already on the way to put it in the cloud anyway, or a hybrid environment at least, depending on the data. So we used to say this is a golden moment for all CIOs and CTOs to bring back their own budget proposal, slap GenAI on the top of it, and get it through the finance team.
Right.
To do what you said before, right? So I would say those if you're doing those things, you're kind of in the middle, if you will. And if you're really advanced, you're already thinking about how do we do this at scale, right? How, if I'm a private equity companies have been really aggressive, let's say, how can I roll this out to all my portfolio companies?
Yep.
Without forcing them to do anything they don't want and without paying for it, ideally. How do we get that benefit out there? And there's massive opportunity. I mean, imagine, for instance, a portfolio company that has 100 or a PE company has 100 portfolio companies, and you take out 30% of the hours, and that translates into, say, 15% EBITDA improvement, either top line, bottom line, or both, with a multiple of 9. At exit, you're talking large numbers of, a lot of value creation in there. But that assumes that there's adoption, it's working, etc. But those are the type of values that are at stake. And these are in addition to and above all other levers that's been out there for
normal
cost cutting, machine learning, etc. It's in addition to, but also independent of. And again, you can get some of these benefits because the big models already exist without having to invest that much money in it. So that's a huge drive for what we call value creation. And if you're going at that in a scalable way, you're at the forefront of this, I would say. Now, if you really want to be ahead of everyone, you're starting to think about the creativity angle of this, how to make your product better, how to make your service better. And, at the very, very extreme of you're starting to think about what's going to happen now to my portfolio companies if every one of their customers, competitors, suppliers also roll out generative AI at the same time. There's going to be a lot of CFOs by the end of this fiscal that get difficult questions from their boards, analysts, investors to paint a picture on what will generative AI do to their 3 to 5 year financials. And it's very, very, very few can answer that question right now, at least even the modeling aspect of it. So we foresee that to be a case. And then finally, I would say that in the if you're in the M&A space, whether you're buying or selling, this can be a really interesting tool. And we're already, you know, our own surveys indicated that more than 90% of the executives that we asked either already have or will this year use generative AI and AI in the M&A process in different aspects of it. More in the front end of the diligence and the structuring phase today, but more and more on the value creation side at the end of it. And think of this, if it's true, which I believe to be the case, that almost every company has that kind of 30% improvement potential inherent in addition to everything else, and you buy that company, if you are a bidder that can confidently factor that benefit into the price, you will win many deals. If not, you will lose many deals.
Right.
So at some point in the future, when you do the diligence of a company, you will have to factor in the untapped productivity improvement from generative AI. And it'll be a key factor in the overall M&A process. And we're hoping to soon be ready with sort of a diligence tool or capabilities to do that at sort of M&A quality and speed. Right now, we can do it. We have a what we call a rapid assessment tool that can take any company, download all the public data about the company, and estimate the dollar opportunity for that company to fully roll out generative AI.
Interesting.
Outside in, and then we can do it inside out with the actual data of the company. In a sort of a current state, we're not yet, you know, using that to advise our buyers and sellers on M&A because of the accuracy and the the
critical new.
Exactly right. But that's probably where I believe the puck is going when it comes to M&A and the use of this, which is relevant for so many VCs and
PE. Oh, absolutely. Yeah, especially when hopefully, at least from what I hear, the deal market is starting to come back. You would probably know a little bit better than me. But well, we are at time. But Per, this has been outstanding. I really think our audience will enjoy this. And you gave me a lot to think about. So I can only imagine, you know, those running their own companies, they've probably got quite a bit to think about too. So thank you for your time. And any parting thoughts as we kind of wrap up?
No, I think this is one of the most interesting trends and disruptions that we're going to see in the market in decades.
That's the internet, right? That's what I keep hearing it being compared to.
Yeah, and there's, you know, there's a lot of it's the internet, it's electricity and so forth. And we know that reality will always need to catch up with part of the interest, et cetera. But there's too much underlying potential for this to go away quickly. And, you know, we have regulatory actions, it's just happening, et cetera. So a lot of unknowns in here for sure. But in my own case, I think this is helping our clients and ourselves walk through this transition might be the most value creation I can do with my time and therefore put my career behind it. But it's going to be a roller coaster ride.
Yes. I feel like it's already been a roller coaster year. So I can only imagine the next few and how quickly things will change. So we'll have to have you back, Per, probably in you know, 6 months. And I bet we'll have a whole different conversation. So, well, thank you again so much. Really appreciate your time and your focus in this topic. And thank you for everything you do. Appreciate it.
Appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to KPMG's Privately Speaking podcast. And be sure to subscribe to this series to be notified of new episodes.